From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Tanya Mosley with Fresh Air. Today, comedian Leslie Jones. In her new memoir, she writes about being on Saturday Night Live and the years she spent working odd jobs to get by before she was famous. She even had a stint working for Scientologists.
Twice. I had two jobs with Scientologists.
A court runner transporting documents and a justice of the peace. She once told a judge she knew her lines by heart.
He was like, you actually don't know it by heart because you're saying awfully wedded husband and awfully wedded wife. And I was like, that's what it is, right? And he was like, it's lawfully.
Jones also shares the advice she got from Jamie Foxx, the toll of being a physical comedian and joining SNL. And later, Justin Chang reviews the new film Maestro, directed by and starring Bradley Cooper. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Tanya Mosley. When comedian and actress Leslie Jones joined the cast of Saturday Night Live in 2014, she held the distinction of being the oldest person to ever join the cast at 47 years old. But that detail might just be the least interesting thing about her. Jones was on Saturday Night Live for 5 seasons, first as a writer, then as a cast member. She became known for her hilarious Weekend Update reports, as well as her outrageous sketches playing everyone from Whoopi Goldberg to Donald Trump. And last week, she guest-hosted The Daily Show. Here she is responding to Trump's comments that if president again, he would root out the vermin in this country.
This man is calling American citizens vermin, when he is literally the definition of vermin. He's talking about throwing... the definition! He's talking about throwing his opponents in jail when he literally should be in jail! Can you believe he is the leading candidate? No. What the f*** America? How did y'all let this happen? Because this ain't my fault. I wasn't paying attention. The man's indicted in every state in America. I didn't know you was allowed to run for the president while you was already running from the popo.
In her new memoir, simply titled Leslie Effin' Jones, I can't say the actual word on the radio, Jones makes clear that she's no overnight success. For years, she worked odd jobs to get by while doing comedy shows everywhere. In the book, Jones also shares details of her life that she's never spoken about before. Her life growing up as a military brat, working comedy clubs in a male-dominated field, and the mistakes and lessons she learned along the way. Leslie Jones has been nominated for 3 Primetime Emmy Awards for her work on Saturday Night Live. And in 2016, she starred in Ghostbusters. In 2021, she starred opposite Eddie Murphy in Coming to America, for which she won an MTV Movie and TV Award. Leslie Jones, welcome to Fresh Air.
Gotta love when a conversation starts with laughing.
Yeah, because I was just like, wow, that's so crazy. When she's reading the credits, I was just like, I went back to sitting in my living room and thinking, oh, God, how long am I going to have to do this until somebody realizes that I'm actually funny?
I know. Yeah. How many moments did you have like that?
A billion. Yes. A billion. Like, it's because I knew I was funny. I knew I was funny, and I knew that they didn't know what I was. They knew that I was an entity. They just did not know. And up until I got SNL, nobody really knew what to really do with me. And everybody, trust me, they tried. But what the problem was is that I knew what I was, but I didn't tell them because I felt like they wouldn't get it.
You are undeniably funny. But you, when you were young, and I'm talking like when you were young, comedy wasn't something you saw yourself being in. Like, you saw it as silly. Like Richard Pryor, but you didn't see yourself in Richard Pryor.
No, I was a funny kid. I every time I meet somebody from the past, they go, yeah, you was crazy. You was like a little fun, but I never thought of myself as funny. I thought of as myself as just like, I just like to have fun, and I was emulating a lot of comics that I would watch, you know. So when it came down to it, like, and my friend entered me in the contest, I was like, I'm not a comic. I always thought I was going to be an actress, that one day that I would play Whoopi Goldberg. Like, I would play a comic. I never thought I would be a comic. Yeah. So,
your friend entered you in this contest, Colorado State University. You were a freshman.
Yeah.
So this contest was the funniest person on campus contest. And you say that the moment you picked up the mic, you walked on the stage, it was like a religious experience.
I can't even explain it more than when I grabbed the mic, I just remember thinking, I've been doing this forever already. Like, oh, my God, this fits like a glove. It's almost like putting on a shirt and going, oh, God, this shirt fits. It almost felt like I saw a line leave from the mic and just went out. And it was like, oh, that's the path I'm taking. It was like I had already been doing it and didn't know I had been doing it. It was just so natural.
And then when you were 19, a young Jamie Foxx was the headliner for this club called The World.
The World, with Magic Johnson used to own The World. It was back in the day, in the day, like 87. This was 87.
So Jamie blew you away. And so you were like, I'm going to blow Jamie away.
First it was like, when Jamie started performing, I was like, oh, there's other comedians other than Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor and Whoopi Goldberg who know how to do this type of comedy, because it's a certain type of comedy. It's a very when you could take from your life and then you could make someone just be right there, or you could just relate. I was like, he's performing like this. And I'm like, oh my God. So that means that I can learn how to do this then. So my friend that was with me, she was, you know, knew the promoter, and I told her to go and like hook up with the promoter, do whatever you gotta do so I could talk to Jamie Foxx. So we all went to Fatburgers. And we was waiting on our burgers, and Jamie was over there. And I think I flirted with him at first, but because I was like, okay, if that's what it's going to take for me to find out what I need to, if you think I'm cute, then I'm definitely going to try to talk to you. But he didn't. He was like, didn't think I was cute or whatever. He just was like, you a youngin'. He knew I was 19. So he was like, you 19. He was like, of course you wasn't funny. He was like, you ain't got nothing to talk about yet. He was like, and the stuff that you talking about, you not funny enough yet to talk about it. He was like, so you just up there doing jokes. He was like, go live. He was like, go live. Go get jobs. Go get fired. Go get hired. Go quit. Go break hearts. Go get your heart broken. Go and live.
Go live.
Go live so you can have something to talk about. So I just remember...
You went to live.
I went to live.
So for 6 years, after meeting Jamie Foxx.
That was in 87.
You quit comedy, essentially. Or you didn't quit, but you like went to go live.
I went to go live. But I'm telling you, at the root of every job I would get, everything I would be assigned to, I would be like, this is temporary. I always went in a temporary because I was like, this is not, I'm going to be a comic. This is just until I'm a comic.
Leslie, we have to go through some of the jobs you held.
Okay.
For a hot minute, you were a justice of the peace.
Yeah, I married people. and I was really good at it. I actually was good at it because I'm funny. But when I first started, the judge pulled me into the office and he was like, hey, are you reading the card when you're doing the ceremony? I was like, nah, I know it by heart. He was like, you actually don't know it by heart because you're saying awfully wedded husband and awfully wedded wife. And I was like, that's what it is, right? Yeah. And he was like, it's lawfully, and please read from the card. And I was like, well, you know, awfully is pretty fun. He just looked, I know he wanted to laugh, but he's just like, Leslie, please go and do it the right way.
And then from there, they're like, all right, let's move her to the annulment office.
And then all the people I married, literally most of them came in and got an annulment. So I was like, I guess the awfully and the lawfully was true. I guess I did jinx y'all mess. So, you know.
What I want to know, though.
Jeez.
You worked for Scientologists.
Yes, I did. Twice. I had two jobs with Scientologists. Because they own Glendale. You don't work in Glendale without working for some Scientologists.
Right, which is right outside of Los Angeles.
So what they do is they buy a lot of businesses. They have a lot of businesses. I guess that's how they bring a lot of money to their thing, or I don't know what it is.
What were you doing for them?
Well, the first job that I had for them was with the Doring Company. And I remember because I used to always had to write it on this... little survey, because that's what they did with surveys. Like, if you bought a car and somebody called you and it'd be like, yeah, we'd like to ask you how your car was.
You were the person
calling. I was that person calling. So you get money for that. So, and it was a good paying job. I remember it, you know, paid the rent. And I lived right around the corner from there. And they loved me because I was very enthusiastic. I would come in, you know, I have an energy. I would come in and, you know, just be happy and everybody be happy to be at work or whatever. And they was always trying to hat me. That's what they call it, hat you. When they want you to join and then they want to move you up, they want to make you feel important and stuff. So I remember the lady, she was moving me up in the office, which I didn't mind. I liked doing the surveys because when she came at me like this, I went back to doing surveys, but she was trying to move me up, but she kept saying, hat me. I want to hat you. I want to hat you. And I was like, what is that hat stuff? What is that? And she was like, oh, you know, in the Scientology world, woo, 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 woo. And I was like, nah, I want to go back to surveys because I'm a Christian.
You let them know I'm a Christian.
I'm a Christian. I believe in God. I don't know what y'all believe in. No. So then I went and worked for a construction company and they were a family deal. And I didn't really like being around them either because I always felt like they was going to kidnap me. I don't know why. So I went and looked for another Scientology because there was a billion of them in Glendale.
Well, look, you definitely took Jamie's advice as far as that's concerned.
Girl, please. Yes. I went and had a life. Yeah.
Let's take a short break. If you're just joining us, my guest is Leslie Jones. She's written a new memoir about her life and her career in comedy. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and today we're talking to comedian and actor Leslie Jones. She's written a new memoir about her life and rise to fame. Jones was nominated for 3 Primetime Emmy Awards for her work on SNL. In 2021, she starred opposite Eddie Murphy in Coming to America, for which she won an MTV Movie and TV Award. Last January, she was the first guest host of The Daily Show after the departure of Trevor Noah. Leslie Jones also stars in the HBO Max series Our Flag Means Death. Leslie, you really like physical comedy.
Yeah.
Lucille Ball, for instance, yeah, taught you that you can't just be happy or sad with your, you know, you can't just like show emotion or happy, yeah, or sadness. You got to show it in your face.
Well, you just be it. I remember being in an audition because I was in a Martin Lawrence movie, and the director, I remember I was auditioning, he was like, Leslie, you don't have to act mean. He was like, you could just be it because you got that face that your emotions is going to come across your face. And Lucille Ball and Carol Burnett, Melissa McCarthy too, like very good, the face, just face. Like that's the one thing I want to learn is that.
You know, I heard Jim Carrey and, of course, we know Jerry Lewis talk about, though, like the physical toll of physical comedy, like, yep, literally on your body. What, yep, about for you? Do you,
yes,
feel it?
Well, you know what's so weird? Like, I played basketball since I was in sixth grade. I didn't start getting injured until I started doing stage stuff and started at SNL and all that. I think those were my injuries, like just because you give it all. Like, to me, John Ritter is one of the best physical.
Wait, can I just say?
Yes.
I don't think I've ever, you wrote about him in the book. I don't think I've ever met anyone else who describes that feeling that you feel for John Ritter. I feel that too. It's like a comfort. He brings a comfort.
I hate that that's one person I never got to meet. Because when I say that man would fall over a couch and I would die laughing because there's no one else who could do that, that jerk thing that he would do. He would do this. He would just. It was just such good movements. And then John Ritter went on to Buffy the Vampire Slayer and played the malfunction robot and won an Emmy for it. I was like, just like artistry, you know, mm-hmm. Buster Keaton. It's just a physical thing. Like, I always tell everybody, don't try to reinvent comedy. Comedy is all its own entity. You're just like you're trying to reinvent the wheel. The wheel will always be round. It needs to be. You know what I'm saying? So just try to just learn the tricks and make them yours. Like, slipping on a banana will always be funny. And I don't care what nobody say. Slipping on a banana will
always be funny.
One of the funniest physical jokes
but
ever.
It's really interesting. You playing basketball from sixth grade. You went to college to play basketball.
Yeah.
And I feel like that feels like that's really physical. And it's also you're running. Like you're,
I didn't
but
never
it's
really
not,
injure myself.
What,
yeah,
is it about like just
because,
being
because
in that?
Because you love it. Like I didn't love basketball like that. I wasn't going to do all of that. But comedy, if I'm trying to get a joke across, oh yeah, I may twist my knee. Like, I didn't fell off stages, I didn't fell off tables, I didn't fell off chairs. It does take a toll on, especially when you start getting older and start forgetting. But let me, yeah, tell you something about the joy of watching physical comedy. If you do it right, people love you because you don't forget that physical move. You don't forget the dancing. You don't forget that. Especially if you're there live and watching them do that. It is magnificent. I love physical comedy.
Do you treat your body differently now? I saw in your last special you had like a brace on your leg.
Well, it's so weird, girl. Let me tell you, the stages that you go through, not only as a comic, but as a woman. When I first started comedy, I thought I had to be sexy. I used to wear heels on stage.
I remember that.
I used to wear the splits and all of that. And then, you know, at the end of it, I'm sweaty and maybe the makeup didn't all melted on me. You look gross. So it's like, and then too, this is why I tell women, don't be afraid to be yourself. Because see, when you, there's women who can go dressed up on stage, then do your thing. But this is what happens when you walk on stage. The first thing that happens is a woman look at you and they go, oh, does she think she cute? And then they look at their man and they go, does my man think she cute? All that's happening while you're trying to open up.
Yeah.
So I always say in your first couple of years, T-shirt, jeans, tennis shoes. If you can make it lovely and cute, do that, because you don't have to prove you're a woman. And listen, you could do whatever you want. I'm telling you, as far as I've been doing this a long time, I know what that's doing.
I want to go back to your early life for a moment,
mm-hmm.
if you're okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Your family growing up was made up of your mom, your dad, and your brother, your
nuclear
younger brother.
Nuclear family, like straight nuclear family,
You all moved around because your dad was in the military,
yeah.
You're a military brat. And your dad later worked at a radio station in Memphis as a studio technician. It was the first all-black station in
WDIA.
The United States.
Yep. Yeah.
Before moving to Inglewood to work for Stevie Wonder's radio
station.
Yeah,
and we moved to Linwood. We moved to Linwood.
Yes.
But the radio station was in Inglewood. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Did you ever visit your dad at work at Stevie Wonder's station?
I might have and just don't remember. I only particular time I remember that I was going to go to work with him was because I was in love with the DeBarge fam.
Who was it?
it was like a DeBarge poster on one of my wall and Duran Duran on the other wall.
Yeah.
So I was just like in love with DeBarge, and they were coming to the radio station. And like whenever you see the fans cry, like you see them cry over Michael Jackson and stuff like that, I used to be like, why? That's how I was about DeBarge. Like, so my dad was like, oh, you're going to come to the studio. And I literally burst into tears. And I said, Daddy, I don't want to go, because I felt they were so beautiful they wouldn't like me, you know, because I'm a little black girl. You know, they're not going to like me. They're all beautiful and light skinned. You know, right now that, you know, thinking about that, that's what I thought.
Taking you back. Absolutely.
You know,
that's
it's so
real.
Weird. You know, that's what I was thinking in my head. If I had said that out loud to my dad would be like, get your butt in the car, girl. You finna go meet these four. But I think he was like, oh, she a fan freaking out, because I was like, oh, my God, I can't meet him. But I sent my brother. And he took a picture, and my brother said he got a sign. And you know what they said? They said that they wish you had came.
Yeah.
I cried all night. I was like, I could have met El DeBarge, but I didn't know what I probably would have fainted or something. And I didn't want to embarrass myself. So funny, on my 44th birthday, I was having it at the Comedy Store, and guess who walks up? El DeBarge. I got to find a picture. When I say the smile in that picture is so big, and I told him that story, and he just laughed. He was like, that is hilarious.
You know, your dad worked at Stevie Wonder's radio station for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the thing that you saw through your dad was a man who wanted to be successful.
He wanted to be, at one time, you know, I think he managed or either got a gig for Tony.
For the group, Tony.
Yeah, but
they wasn't
famous then. And I think he got a gig for them, and then they signed with someone else. But, like, yeah, he wanted to be in the business for sure.
He wanted, but he never quite got
That's why I wish he was alive, because, Lord, he would love everything. Oh, my God, he would love this. Oh, he would just be tickled pink with this.
So, thing is, you always knew. Seeing him, seeing how he moved. Mm-hmm. How did it influence how you moved?
My dad always worked. He always worked. He was always thinking. My dad was always so super confident in himself and in his ideas. And he would always tell me, like, this is so funny because, like, I hear, like, parents be trying to get their kids to get married or try to get their daughter married. Or my dad never did that. My dad was always like, I want you to make your own money. He used to always say, I don't want no man taking care of you. I want you to take care of yourself. Be undeniable. They gonna tell you that you black and that you can't make it. They're gonna tell you you're a woman and you can't make it. They're gonna tell you you're a black woman and you can't make it. He said, please don't listen to them. He said, because if you work hard, you can't be denied.
Our guest today is comedian and actress Leslie Jones, who has written a new memoir about her life and career. We'll hear more of our conversation after a short break. And later, Justin Chang reviews the new film Maestro. I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from FX, presenting Fargo from creator Noah Hawley and starring Juno Temple, Jon Hamm, and Jennifer Jason Leigh. The series returns on November 21st on FX, streaming on Hulu, and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Tanya Mosley, and today we're talking to comedian and actor Leslie Jones. She's written a new memoir titled Leslie Effin' Jones. I can't say the actual word on the radio. It's about her life and rise to fame. Jones was on Saturday Night Live for 5 seasons. She's also appeared in the 2016 female reboot of Ghostbusters and in Eddie Murphy's 2021 Coming to America sequel. Last January, she was the first guest host for The Daily Show after the departure of Trevor Noah. When we left off, Leslie Jones was talking about growing up with her family. You also had a really special relationship with your mom.
Yeah.
She had a stroke during your freshman year in college.
Yeah.
I got chills reading about the dream that you had the night before you got
so
the call
scary.
That
so
she had the stroke.
Weird.
Yeah. Would you mind sharing that story?
Yes. Okay. So, I hope I don't get emotional. But I remember, you know, I'm going to tell you, kids, we take advantage of our parents. We do not love them as much as we need to love them. We complain more than we love them. I used to fuss at her because she would come up to the campus and clean up my room when I wasn't there. Like, she would just do stuff like that. And I remember her talking to one of my teammates.
Your basketball teammates
in
college.
And they were like, she's so good. And I just remember we was in, we was playing in Utah, and we were delayed at the airport. All of us was laying on the floor because it was a big basketball team. All of us tall, we laying on the floor, and I fell asleep because I could sleep anywhere. Then my coach would just be so angry because he'd be like, you just fall asleep anywhere.
Yeah.
So I wish I could do that now, those days. Anyway, I fell asleep, and I just remember this big white room. It was just a white room. Nothing was in it. And it was just a silver table. And my mom was in the middle of that table. She had those white little white robe on. And she was in a fetal position. And I just remember waking up and ran to a telephone. Because I was like, hey. My brother answered crying. He was like, they just took mom to the hospital, you know. And I was like, he was just crying. He was like, I don't know what's wrong. She couldn't breathe. And it was just like he was freaking out. So I always tell everybody, and I tell this and I say this all the time, it is a very, very, very scary world without your parents, especially ones that loved you. And I know they don't always get it right. But at some point, you have to give them some grace.
There was this moment, because your mother, after she had the stroke, she was never the same again. And you looked at her. There was a moment when you went home, you looked at her, and you realized that she would never be the same. And in
I said goodbye to her.
You said goodbye.
I said goodbye to her. And it's not like I didn't go visit her and stuff after that, but I was like, you are not going to ever be my mom again. And I hate that I maybe did that because maybe I should have put effort forward for her rehabilitation. But I was a kid, you know, and real talk, the main thing in my head is I remember when the last time she got sick and almost died, she said to me, the reason that I think I made it was because I asked God to let me survive until my children could take care of themselves. So I just remember thinking, yes, my mom is sick. But every time I went to go and visit her, she always had this look of like, you better be. Please be out there. Please don't be out there giving up.
Like Could she speak?
No, she couldn't speak or nothing, but she knew what was going on. And I would go and visit her, and I would cry with her. Anytime my brother was mean to me, I would go and cry with her. And she would just, she understood, you know, I saw her more than anyone. So,
yeah. Your mom and dad died 6 months apart.
Which is really weird because I think my mom secretly probably was trying to outlive my dad.
Oh, really?
Because I think everybody was, I think with everything that happened between them and how everything went, I think my mom was just like, yeah, I'm outlive you. I'm outlive you. But yeah, she passed away 6 months after my dad passed away. And
at the time, you were a working comic at the time, but you hadn't made it yet.
I hadn't made it yet, and they did not die with life insurance, so I didn't go to either one of their funerals because I was working to pay for them.
Leslie, I'm just thinking about what you had to access within yourself, though, to go on stage, knowing you were doing these sets, making people laugh so that you could pay for your parents' funerals.
Girl, that first gig, because I had to go to Amsterdam, and I remember I missed the first flight. I missed the first flight that was booked, and it was because that had happened. And I'm like, my friend came and picked me up with her boyfriend. Man, I was crying so hard because nobody had ever seen me cry like that. Oh, I'm trying not to cry now. It was really hard. I was helpless in everything. You know, I wasn't rich to send them money. I wasn't. And then hearing about my dad, who was such a strong person. He was so strong. 6'5", he was such a strong man. And for him to be so weak when he died. And it's just too so unexpectedly because I always thought I would get the call by my mom. And yeah, that first gig out of the box, because I was so, you know, I can work through a lot of pain now, but I don't know. I think that might have been the first experience of me trying to perform under such pain. Like, and also, too, death is like something else. Like, whenever, you know, it's a distance death, that's different than somebody right up on you death. Yeah. Like, your dad, like, it was just so hard to perform. And I was awful that first night. But the promoter was like, man, the fact that you perform, he was like, you're definitely getting paid. And you're going to be, and I told him, I was like, I promise it won't be like this, you know, tomorrow night. So, yeah, it was hard.
Both your mother and your brother.
Yeah.
Died at the age of 38. And you
well,
actually
my mom
thought...
got sick at the age of 38. She actually died like 20-something years later.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, my brother died at 38, though.
And you really felt like maybe you wouldn't live that long.
Yeah, 38. I was like, oh, they trying to get rid of all the Joneses. I was like, I'm next. So after my brother died, I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm about to do everything. I did not care. I don't care what nobody say. I'm living like I'm doing the jokes that I thought I couldn't. I'm doing everything.
Let's take a short break. If you're just joining us, my guest is Leslie Jones. She's written a new memoir about her life and career in comedy. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Columbia Pictures and Apple Original Films presenting Napoleon. Directed by Ridley Scott and starring Joaquin Phoenix, Napoleon tells the story of Napoleon Bonaparte's rise to power, exclusively in theaters Thanksgiving. And from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world where innovation meets the law.
This is Fresh Air. Today, we're talking to comedian and actor Leslie Jones. She's written a new memoir about her life and rise to fame. Jones had a long career in stand-up, but her career really took off when she was hired to work at Saturday Night Live in 2014, where she was a writer and a cast member for 5 seasons. We talked to Jones about her time at SNL. Leslie Jones told us how she got her audition for Saturday Night Live and how it involved comedian Chris Rock catching her stand-up act. So, Chris Rock saw you at one of your sets, was like, oh, yeah, call Lorne Michaels and said, you got to have this woman. And you went on an audition because they were looking for a black woman at the time. So the audition process for SNL sounds pretty intense, of course. And you were up against some pretty heavy hitters. Like, it was you and several comedians, but then there were some black actresses.
Okay. They weren't heavy hitters to me. I mean, listen. I'm Leslie Jones. I'm the heavy hitter walking into the room. Trust and believe, give all respect to those ladies. But none of them was a comic like me. Yeah. None of them was going to ever challenge me on stage. But what they had on me, though, was the sketch stuff. They had that down on me.
So SNL hired you as a writer. You didn't want to be a writer. You were like so dejected by that, but you took it.
No, but Chris had warned me. Chris had already told me. He said, listen, there's no way they're going to let you go. He was like, I know Lauren's not going to let you go. And Keenan told me the same thing. Keenan was like, there's no way.
Once you get in as a writer,
No way they're letting you walk out the building. Mm-hmm. They know you're something. So they called me and hired me as a writer. Yeah. And I told Lauren, I was like, listen, I'm being honest with you. I'm not a writer. I'm a in front of the camera chick.
But he told you.
He
you
said,
know,
just come. Yeah, yes. I don't know what to do with you, but we'll figure it out.
Right.
You know.
I mean, writing in the beginning, it wasn't easy because you had all of these pitches that were rejected at first.
Yeah, because I was pitching like a comic.
Yes.
Like a sketch person. And that's the thing that I have really had to learn was that when you're writing a joke in a sketch, it has to have foundation. Like, it has to have a story. It has to have character names. It has to have, you know, a flow. It can't. Yeah. It's not just you on stage talking about it, you know.
So, Chris Rock, Kenan Thompson, they were like, they're going to want you. You're there. You're a writer. You're doing your thing. You're trying to work out even writing.
Yeah.
But once you started performing, in many ways, you write about this in the book, they started to treat you like a caricature.
You mean once I became a cast member?
Once you became a cast member.
Well, because, again, I've been doing comedy so long, it's like I know what I am and I know what I'm giving them. At SNL, they take that one thing and they ring it. They ring it because that's the machine. So whatever it is that I'm giving that they're so happy about, they feel like it's got to be that all the time or something like that. So it was like a caricature of myself, you know what I'm saying? So it was like now either I'm trying to love on the white boys or beat up on the white boys, or I'm doing something just like loud. I knew once I did these things, though, I knew it was going to happen because I know the power of them.
You were so good at Weekend Update.
Yes, because that's comedy. That's nothing but me sitting down doing stand-up behind the desk. That was my, yo, let me tell you something. That was like, yes, that was mine, you know? So when I left, I was like, yeah, this is the worst. But no, man, it was just bittersweet. Because it really is a training. You know, for some people, it should be the springboard.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
And so much good has happened from your time on SNL.
Yeah.
It also sounds like Kenan Thompson became like
your homie. The first day I met Kenan, we were brother and sister instantly. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny. Love Lorne Michaels. At the time when you, like I said, when you leave, you're just so angry because you can't. But in his defense, I used to always be like, he's a puppet master. So he has to make the cast happy, has to make the writers happy. He has to make the WGA happy, has to make NBC happy. Then he has to make a family in Omaha, Nebraska, who's watching the show happy. Imagine the strings that have to go out to him. So it's a machine that has to work.
It's so interesting when you say it's like a machine because, right, you see folks like you on there. You're like, yes, there's Leslie Jones. I mean, all the way back when Eddie Murphy was on
there.
But there's always just one. And they always do have their signature. And then they leave.
And in fairness, because I remember I was talking to another cast member that retired. And they said, but in fairness, like, that's how they do all of them. Not just the black ones. And I looked back and I was like, oh, that's right, Taryn. Taryn Killam. Taryn wanted to do so much other stuff, but they would only have Taryn in those very masculine and singing and stuff. And I said, oh!
This is the machine.
Yeah, this is a machine. Mm-hmm. You know?
The advice Jamie Foxx gave you about, like, living life, mm-hmm. being yourself, you have definitely, like, a catalog of stories now.
Yeah.
I gotta ask you about one you've talked about.
All of them, baby.
You've talked about this one a lot already over the last few years, but there's an element of it that I want to just talk with you about. So you met somebody on Match.com.
Oh, yeah.
You sent them nudes, and then the FBI was involved over it, because you're famous by now. Like, this is, like,
which
you're famous.
Which is so funny that you're not smart enough to know.
That you're famous.
No, but wait, you know what's so funny about that? I started dating someone a little bit after that, and I sent him a nude, and he literally...
Again?
He literally sent me back the text, you ain't learned yet.
The thing I want to ask you about, so the FBI was involved.
Right.
It was a whole thing.
Oh, my God.
Because you sent this person nudes, and then they were like, we're going to use this against you. TMZ even called you and was like...
Yeah, well, what happened was they got Homeland Security involved, and then the FBI got involved, and they took over. And instead of them just taking my computer, they made me send what it is I sent to the dude.
So you sent nudes again.
And then, so whoever was hacking me, because the Ghostbuster stuff was going on too, and I was fighting against that. So whoever was hacking me was just trying to hack me, because dude from Twitter was like, they are on your account.
And
like, they
have to protect me. So the audience knows, with the Ghostbuster stuff, you were starring in Ghostbusters and you were getting a lot of hate on
social media. I was getting a lot of hate already.
It.
So it was just like in the midst of all of that happening. So I know it was just super hackers going, we're going to get her, whatever, you know, whatever. They went into the email because they got my passport, they got my ID, and then they got the nudes. So I woke up to a phone call from the chick from TMZ, the black girl. I hope you listening, because I will never forgive you. I will never forgive you. Because she calls my phone and she goes, hey, do you know that your nudes and your passport and your ID is up on? And I've looked at the number. I was like, who is this? Oh, this is so-and-so, so-and-so from TMZ. And I was like, well, how did you get my number? Did you use the number? And she was like, well, I'm just trying. I was like, you ain't trying to help. And I hung up and I called my publicist. And my publicist had it down in 20 minutes, but 20 minutes is like 20 days on the internet.
So you got hacked in addition to being threatened by this person you met on Match.com.
Right.
And so then you put together a sketch for the Emmys and for Weekend Update.
Yes, yes. So after all the hacking and all that stuff happened, we were like, you know, I was just like, I'm not going to play the victim. I'm not a victim. This is not a victim. This is a me being harassed by some disgusting hacker that went into my private thing. So they wanted me to play a victim, and I'm not a victim. I've refused to play a victim because that means that you don't have control of nothing about me. You want to see me naked? Ask. That's right. What it's about. So when the Emmys hit me, I was like, this is the perfect sketch to do with the accountants. Like, y'all got this in the suitcase. Y'all need to put my Twitter account in there. And, you know, that was the whole gist of it. Now, when I got back to Weekend Update, you know, I am that person that's going to address it. And I really, really was about, like, if you wanted to see me naked, ask. I have a trove of pictures I can send you. And they way better quality than the ones that got hacked, you know. And I the whole thing there was a preaching about is like, no one else has the power to come and break you. The only person that can break you is you. Hmm. Don't give nobody else that power.
You've worked so hard to get to where you are. Does success feel like you thought it would?
Absolutely not. I was just telling this to somebody today. I was like, man, I used to sit on my gigs when I was with nothing and was selling DVDs and stuff. I would sit after my gig. I would run to the front just to hug and sign stuff and be and get in touch with people. And I thought that when I got famous, that was going to be my most favorite part, was connecting with my fans. And it is sometimes, but it is hard. It is very hard. Because I have to always tell myself, okay, you're famous. Hey, you can't smack that person, man. You're famous. Hey, man, you can't curse that person out, man. You're famous. You know, now some things I break through. I'll be like, if I'm going to go to the Beyonce concert, I'm going to the Beyonce concert. It's right. Happening. You know, y'all just going to have to deal with it. And I always try to do the Arsenio Hall, Magic Johnson rule is to make yourself seen so much that people get used to seeing you so they don't attack you.
Hmm.
And a lot of people see me out all the time. I'm always at the gym. I'm always Ralph's. I'm always at the Comedy Store. And I act normal as hell. I don't shut stuff down. I don't sin ahead. I try to be as normal as hell. I try to dress myself down. The mohawk was a big thing. I had to get rid of the mohawk because
it was too much of a signature.
And people, like, I could be with Kenan and they would not know.
Even see Kenan Thompson.
They have asked Kenan take pictures and they look and go, oh my God, Kenan. Yeah, like, it's just a thing. You're a 6 foot tall smiling black woman with a mohawk, they're going to recognize you. So I had to calm that down. It's a lot of things, you know, but I refuse to be trapped in my house. I'm not that type of star.
Leslie Jones, thank you. Thank you for being you. Thank you for this book. Just thank you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Leslie Jones is a comedian and author of a new memoir. Coming up, Justin Chang reviews the new film Maestro about composer Leonard Bernstein, directed by and starring Bradley Cooper. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. 5 years after directing and acting in the remake of A Star is Born, Bradley Cooper is once again in front of and behind the camera with Maestro, in which he plays the famed composer Leonard Bernstein. The movie centers on Bernstein's marriage to the actor Felicia Montalegre, played by Carey Mulligan. Maestro began a limited theatrical release this week and will start streaming December 20th on Netflix. Our film critic Justin Chang has this review.
We're in the thick of year-end movie season, or as I've come to think of it, biopic season, when some of our finest actors line up to deliver their most Oscar-friendly feats of historical impersonation. Right now you can see Rustin on Netflix, starring Coleman Domingo as the civil rights activist Bayard Rustin. This week also brings Joaquin Phoenix in Napoleon, and next month, keep an eye out for Adam Driver in Ferrari, playing the founder of the Italian sports car empire. One of this year's strongest biopics is Maestro, an exquisite new drama starring Bradley Cooper as the conductor and composer Leonard Bernstein. Cooper, who also directed and co-wrote the movie with Josh Singer, gives a dazzling multi-decade arc of a performance. We first see Bernstein near the end of his life, playing a somber piano piece from his opera, A Quiet Place, and remembering his late wife, the actor Felicia Montalegre. The movie then flashes back to 1943, when a 20-something Lenny makes his electrifying Carnegie Hall debut, guest conducting the New York Philharmonic, his first step toward becoming the most famous conductor in American history. Cooper captures Lenny's brilliant musical mind, his gregarious energy, and his intense attractiveness to both men and women. Matt Bomer gives a brief but poignant turn as the clarinetist David Oppenheim, one of his many lovers. It's around this time that Lenny meets Felicia, who's just getting started as a New York stage actor. She's played, superbly, by Carey Mulligan. They're introduced at a party by Lenny's sister, Shirley, played by Sarah Silverman.
Hello! I thought you might be here. You've certainly been making the rounds. Have you met the gang? Betty and Adolf, they're just arriving.
Hello.
Hello.
Ellen, of course, you've run into her at a mother's studio, no doubt.
Hello, Felicia.
Who did I miss? Have I missed anyone?
Just the piano player.
Well, I figured you needed no introduction.
Hello, I'm Lenny.
Hello, Felicia.
Bernstein, like that one.
Montalegre.
Montalegre?
Montalegre Cohn.
Cohen? Montalegre Cohn. Well, that's an interesting marriage of words.
This early stretch of the movie was shot in black and white by Matthew Libatique, whose marvelously fluid camera work conveys Lenny and Felicia's boundless sense of possibility. One playful sequence uses a musical number from Bernstein's own On the Town to capture both Lenny's attraction to men and his very real feelings for Felicia. In time, Lenny and Felicia marry, buy a house in Connecticut, and raise three children. Meanwhile, Lenny continues to have affairs. As the years pass, the black and white shifts to color, and the once freewheeling camera work slows to a melancholy crawl. Even as Lenny's career flourishes, the cracks in his and Felicia's marriage are widening. The beauty of Maestro is that it sees the complexity, the tragedy, and the undeniable passion and tenderness of the Bernstein's relationship. Crucially, it gives both leads equal dramatic weight. Like Cooper's 2018 directing debut, A Star is Born, this is a remarkably even portrait of a complicated showbiz marriage. It even strives for balance in the way it presents both characters as artists. Unsurprisingly, the movie can only squeeze in a handful of Bernstein's creative highlights, whether it's dropping in a bit of the West Side Story score or a reference to his famously polarizing 1971 theater piece, Mass. But there are also glimpses of Felicia's acting career, including her appearance on the arts anthology series Camera 3, shortly before she's diagnosed with cancer. Mulligan, who receives top billing, gives one of her best and most piercing performances. She fully captures Felicia's anger at her husband's philandering, her frustration at having to dwell in his artistic shadow, and her persistent love for him, despite his exasperating flaws. Cooper plays Lenny as a font of energy, charming and irrepressible. At times, there is something a little overly imitative about the actor's mannerisms, especially during Lenny's later years. But this is still a complex and persuasive performance. Crucially, Cooper doesn't soft-pedal the character's selfishness or his failings as a husband and father. When the trailer for Maestro was first released, there was controversy around Cooper's decision to wear a prosthetic nose, raising questions about, among other things, whether non-Jewish actors, like Cooper, should play Jewish characters. That debate won't be resolved here, but it's worth noting that Cooper employs many cosmetic enhancements to play Bernstein over roughly 5 decades, and his performance is too rich to be reduced to just one detail. In the end, we believe Cooper not just because of any physical resemblance, but because he so fully captures Lenny's charisma, the way his love for music and for people seems to flow out of him. We don't see him do much actual conducting until late in the movie, when Cooper recreates a famous 1976 Bernstein performance with the London Symphony Orchestra at Ely Cathedral. The piece is Mahler's Second Symphony, often known as his Resurrection Symphony, fitting for a sequence in which Bernstein, pouring sweat and waving his baton, really does seem to live again.
Justin Chang is the film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed the new film Maestro. On Monday's show, how some conspiracy theories about the deep state have roots in UFO conspiracy theories. We talk with journalist Garrett Graff about his new book, UFO. It's about reported sightings, how they're investigated, and what the military keeps secret and why, and the scientific search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shorrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman, Julian Hirschfeld, and Al Banks. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krinzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Susan Nyakundi. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Tanya Mosley.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from FX, presenting Fargo from creator Noah Hawley and starring Juno Temple, Jon Hamm, and Jennifer Jason Leigh. The series returns on November 21st on FX, streaming on Hulu. And from Workday, an enterprise management cloud focused on providing organizations with a system to continuously plan for all what-if scenarios. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world.